Hour three of your Tuesday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. Welcome back to the program. Our phone number, if you want to take part, 651-989-5855, or use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. One of our listeners, John, tweeted at you using the hashtag TCNT, says, I washed my car yesterday. Now it drives like an Indy car.
Of course it does.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't.
Haven't you ever seen The Aviator?
No. That's not how it works.
No! Have you seen, The Aviator, right?
Actually, I haven't.
Yeah, you've never seen The Aviator?
No.
Okay, in The Aviator, all right, Howard Hughes, okay, he decides to get rid of the biplane, to knock the wing off, wants to make the world's fastest plane, right?
Yeah.
And so at one point, they streamline it, but it wasn't streamlined enough. Why? Because the bolts were still sticking out. So they had to make the bolts flush. Why? So that it was more aerodynamic, so it goes faster. So when my car has got a bunch of ice and snow gunked underneath it, it's slowing it down. When you wash it, it goes faster and drives better. And I feel better about me.
That's the key, right?
Not all the key, but it is a key.
We are pleased to be joined in studio, and you're going to have to correct me once again, but
good luck.
Stand-up economist Yoram Bauman.
Pretty close. Yoram Bauman, yes.
Yoram Bauman.
Can we just call you Mr. PhD?
You can call me anything you want.
PhD Yoram, stand-up economist. Tonight, you are going to be at Kauffman Memorial Union at the University of Minnesota starting at 7 p.m. President's Room, third floor. What are you going to be speaking to the little kiddies about?
I make a living doing stand-up comedy about economics. So
How do you make that happen?
Pretty much the only thing I have going for me is low expectations. I will tell you the first joke I ever told on a comedy stage, which was that when I told my father that I was going to be a stand-up economist, he said, Yoram, he said, you can't be a stand-up economist. And I said, why not? And he said, because there's no demand. And I said, it gets better. I said, don't worry, Dad, I'm a supply-side economist. I just stand up and let the jokes trickle down. I believe in the laugher curve. I don't know if is this getting better or worse.
I appreciate them. I like them.
So, you know, I tell jokes about how, you know, you might be an economist if you think that America's next top model should be an endogenous growth model with technological change. You might be an economist if you don't read human interest stories because they don't interest you. You might be an economist if you adamantly refuse to sell your children because you think they'll be worth more later.
So being an economist, I presume that part of what you do is look at ways to make money. Has this worked out for you?
Thanks for asking. I really do appreciate that. You know, the number one question that most people ask me when I tell them that I'm a stand-up economist is they say, well, what do you really do for a living? I actually make a living doing stand-up comedy about economics, mostly colleges and corporate events. And, you know, I'm the only stand-up economist in the whole world. It says that on the internet, so it must be true. And fortunately, as an economist, I know a thing or two about monopoly pricing. So, you know, I make a living doing this. Yes,
good. Thanks for asking, Dad. How did it occur to you to take your economics training and knowledge and spin it in this direction?
So when I was in graduate school at the University of Washington in Seattle getting my PhD, I to blow off steam, I wrote a parody of the 10 Principles of Economics in a popular textbook. Then it ended up on YouTube, and it got a million hits. And my academic career, to be perfectly honest, did not go quite as well as I had hoped. Mm-hmm. So I had some extra time to sort of pursue the comedy path. And then people started emailing me and asking me if they could hire me to do comedy, and I started saying yes.
Well, you know, I have to imagine that your knowledge, right, and on the economy and being an economist, this particular topic and doing comedy with it, you're gonna have the opportunity to educate individuals and keep people interested more so than just talking straight up about it, right? I mean, you've found a nice niche where you can take what it is you do with the stand up, apply it to your knowledge. And again, it's just I would believe you have a better opportunity to reach kids like you're going to tonight through this means than just going and straight up having a forum, you know, talking about the economy.
Yeah, if I was given a serious lecture tonight at 7 o'clock, then I wouldn't be here with the two of you because you'd be like, we're going to get somebody interesting on our
it's
show.
It's true. No, we bought a hook, line, and sinker, you know, stand-up economists. We're like, all right.
There's a sucker born every minute. So, you know, I have a couple cartoon books about economics, microeconomics and macroeconomics. And you know, oftentimes what I hear from students is that they spent $200 on their textbook and didn't read it. And then they spent $12 on my cartoon books. And that's what they actually learned some economics from.
Yeah, so. I was flipping through. You brought in your cartoon introduction to economics here. And just flipping through it, I mean, it's really clever idea. I mean, really smart idea to take that material and present it in that form. Is very clever, very smart.
Well, thank you. And it's you know, it's capitalism,
right?
I like we found a market niche, my co-author and I, and we're milking it for all that we can.
As I'm sure that you've encountered, it is an area that our public school systems are woefully inadequate in preparing kids for. We do not teach young adults about economics. You know, we teach them math. But we never go into, and I've never understood this, we never get, when they start entering that young adulthood, teenage years, high school, early college, practical math, consumer math, the type of math that they're really going to need to be able to set budgets to determine, you know, how much they're going to make versus how much they're going to take home versus how much they need to save if they want to do things like buy a car or buy a house, things like that. Real economic math seems to be completely abandoned in our education system.
This is a comedy show, gentlemen. You're setting the bar. I think you're setting the bar a little high. So there actually, I think there is an economics requirement in Minnesota public schools. I'm actually doing a free show at Armstrong High School tomorrow morning. So I think there's definitely an effort to do that. But you know, I've taught at the high school level. I've taught at the college level, and education is hard.
Yeah.
Education is hard, so most folks end up learning at the school of hard knocks, and I think that's the way it's gonna continue being.
What do you hope? What is your hope in doing what you do? I mean, what is ultimately sort of your goal with doing your stand up? You know, being a stand up economist like tonight. What do you hope the biggest takeaway is going to be from the individuals at the Kauffman Memorial Union at the University of Minnesota? What do you think? What do you hope they walk out with tonight?
I hope they walk out thinking that economics is interesting. I hope they walk out thinking that guy was pretty funny. I hope they walk out with a copy of my book that they have purchased at full price. You know, here's my sense of economics. There's a ton of interesting content in economics. And, you know, economists, we don't know everything about everything, but we know a lot about a fair amount of stuff, you know, in the years since Adam Smith. And a lot of that stuff is important for our world, for our political system. And I think there's a level at which people know that they should be learning this, mm-hmm. but there's also this block that says, oh, it's boring. It's hard. It's inaccessible. And part of what I'm trying to do is provide an entree, right? And a nice path for folks to say, hey, this is actually not all that inaccessible. You can get it through comedy. You can get it through cartoon books. And, you know, one of the great motivations in life, I feel like, especially for students, if you're in a classroom full of people who are laughing at a joke and you don't get the joke, you want to get the joke. And if the joke happens to be about economics or free trade or whatever, then that means that you want to understand something about free trade or mutual gains from trade or externalities or whatever it is that you're talking about.
Do you use a lot of sort of like current events or things in the news as like source material to sort of make it relevant and accessible to your audiences?
I do some topical humor. I have jokes about politics and, you know, the political situation. I don't do super topical humor like what was in the news yesterday, mm-hmm. But a lot of political issues turn out to be evergreens.
Yeah, I was going to say, coming from Seattle, I mean, you got to have just a sort of a chock full of material there to pull from.
There's certainly a bunch of news from Seattle. You know, the national scene, the deficit apparently is back in the news. So, you know, my joke about the deficit is that folks on the left blame the folks on the right and folks on the right blame the folks on the left. But I actually blame the people in the middle, right? Like, you know, it's people on the politicians on the left are always saying, well, you know, we'd like to have more money for roads or schools or hospitals. And the swing voters are like, yeah, that sounds great. And then the politicians on the right are saying, well, we should cut taxes. And the swing voters are saying, yeah, that's great. And then it turns out we have a budget deficit, which is a little bit like, you know, and the swing voters and the center voters blame the politicians, which is like going to the doctor and the doctor tells you that you've been putting on weight. And the left side of your brain says, well, maybe I should exercise more. And the right side of your brain says, well, maybe I should stop eating so many donuts. And the middle part of your brain says, well, maybe I should get a new doctor. you know, so one of the callers or guests you had on in the last hour or so was talking about how, you know, the Obama stimulus plan like really bothered him. But then as like infrastructure, well, we kind of need some infrastructure. Well, look, I mean, part of what economists do and maybe part of the reason why we have a bad rap is that we lay out the actual choices that are there. It's like either you want to pay for infrastructure or you want your bridges to fall down, right? Like you can't have both. Like if you want to pay for stuff, the money's got to come from somewhere. It's either coming from you or we're borrowing and it's going to come from our children. You know, you got to make tough choices in your personal life and in political life for the country.
Talking with Yoram Bauman again tonight, Kauffman Memorial Union University of Minnesota, a stand-up economist. Now, you were the co-chair of the Washington State effort to impose a carbon tax, and there's an article here. Was this article in the Washington Post? Was this penned by you, or no?
No, okay. It was the editorial board of the Washington
Post. Oh, this was the editorial board of Washington Post. Okay. So the left's opposition to a carbon tax shows there's something deeply wrong with the left. The referendum essentially failed because of liberal identity politics. Get into a bit of the story and what happened.
Well, we ended up putting the first ever carbon tax on the ballot in the United States. It was an attempt to be bipartisan, to do something that was kind of middle of the road.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening was we ended up getting attacked by everybody. So the policy was, let's have a carbon tax. Let's have a tax on fossil fuels. I happen to think that the scientific evidence is pretty convincing that climate change is an issue and that we should take reasonable steps to deal with it. And so our policy in Washington State was, hey, let's have a tax on fossil fuels and let's offset that with a reduction in the state sales tax. Basically, there were some other details, but basically it was, hey, you're going to pay a little more for fossil fuels and you're going to pay a little bit less for everything else that you buy. And that's going to incentivize people through the market system to conserve on their use of fossil fuels. It's going to promote technologies like Elon Musk and, you know.
So you basically said it. You set it up to fail.
Being too smart about
was,
it?
Was that the...
I've never had it summarized like that, but I see your brilliant insight into the political situation. You know, so we basically ended up getting opposed by folks on the right who, in my view, incorrectly don't care about climate change. And we ended up getting opposed by folks on the left who wanted the carbon tax, but they wanted the money for sort of big government stuff for spending on green things.
Yeah.
And our effort, you know, and we did get some support from folks on the right, economists, Rob McKenna, who narrowly lost the governor's race in 2012 to Democrat Jay Inslee, came out in support. Former U.S. Senator Slade Gorton came out in support. So we did get some support from folks on the right, and we got some support from folks on the left. But, for example, both major party governor's candidates came out against the policy. We ended up getting 41% of the vote, which, as I like to say, is not bad, given that we were opposed by just about everybody.
Well, that's the problem I have with a lot of these programs is they'll say that this tax is being instituted to combat this specific thing, but more often than not, it just doesn't. It ends up just going to everything else, and they don't offset it. My response when I see things like that is, why can't you use the money you already have?
Yeah, that's fair enough. But folks on the right who, here's the lesson I think from Washington State, right? At the same time that our measure was on the ballot, which was, let's have a carbon tax, let's deal with climate change with a tax on fossil fuels the way that economists think we ought to, let's cut the sales tax by the same amount so the overall tax burden's not going to go up. We're not trying to make our tax system bigger. We're just trying to make our tax system smarter. At the same time that our measure was on the ballot, there was a measure on the ballot to raise the state sales tax by a half point, collect $54 billion over the next 30 years to expand a light rail system in the Seattle area that is projected to reduce emissions in 2040 by less than half of 1%.
That's a really dumb idea too.
And that, and guess which one passed?
The light rail.
The light rail one did. And part of the reason why that one passed, I think, and why our measure didn't pass, was if you're on the right side of the political spectrum, if you're one of my fellow conservatives, then you need to think about, well, like, there are a bunch of folks, including climate scientists, who think that climate change is an issue. And we can try to deal with it in smart, market-friendly ways. But if you're just going to say no to everything, then you're going to end up with a political system that's going to pass some dumb ideas. So our proposal was, I'd like to think of kind of a bend without breaking approach. And we need more folks on the right side of the political spectrum to stand up and say, hey, maybe this is a risk, and here's a smart way that we can deal with it that's not going to hurt our pocketbooks, that's not going to hurt our economy.
Was the rationale behind the carbon tax to disincentivize that behavior by taxing it more?
Yeah, so the idea is that if you make fossil fuels more expensive, then the market system will work to find ways to reduce consumption of fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So that's through, if you talk about utilities moving from coal to natural gas, from natural gas to renewables, if the price is right. If you talk about households, it's inflating your tires so you get better gas mileage, driving a little more slowly, buying a more fuel-efficient car if you get an opportunity to do that. All those millions of individual decisions that are made in the free market economy every day are going to have a little bit of a finger on the scale to reduce emissions and to protect against the risk that climate change is a real thing that's going to really impact our lives in this century.
What sent you, getting back to what you do, what initially sent you down this path? What sort of sparked your interest to follow this way, to have this career? What sparked your, I mean, you're trying to make, you know, economics interesting and, you know, more readily accessible. I'm curious what you found most interesting about it that put you down that path.
So I came across this, what really sparked my interest was actually this idea that said, hey, let's tax bad things that we want less of instead of taxing good things that we want more of. All right, let's tax pollution, which we want less of, instead of taxing jobs and income and savings and investment, which is stuff that we want more of. And I remember thinking when I came across this in college, I thought, hey, that is an intellectually beautiful idea. And it's an idea that folks who aren't economists maybe won't immediately come across, like the idea of trying to address environmental problems. Like, I live in Salt Lake City now, pretty bad air pollution in Salt Lake City. Sometimes it looks like Beijing. And I've lived in Beijing, and I don't want to continue living in that kind of environment. So the economic idea is, hey, if you want less air pollution, maybe you should use market forces and have a tax on air pollution. And then if you use that revenue to reduce other taxes, like, what a brilliant idea. Not my idea, but a brilliant idea. And that was what led me to say, hey, I want to spend 5 years of my life getting a PhD in economics. And then at the end of that 5 years, it turned out that, to be perfectly honest, my academic career did not go quite as well as I'd hoped. So I had some extra time to spend at open mic nights. And fortunately, that part of my career path took off.
The Stand-Up Economist. You can find out more information by going to standupeconomist.com. Yoram Bauman.
You're working on it. You're getting there.
I'm trying, man. I really am.
Tonight, Mr. PhD.
At the Kauffman Memorial Union at the University of Minnesota. That's tonight at 7 p.m. I'm sure it's going to be a fantastic show. Thanks for coming in, man. It's great to meet you.
Thank you for having me. It's
really
been my
interesting
pleasure.
Stuff. And I love the books. I'll tweet out a link to your website and the books so people can find out more information.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Coming up, new petition. We got a big movie opening up this weekend, Black Panther. New petition wants 25% of Black Panther profits to be invested in Black communities. And we will be getting into that Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act editorial from the Star Tribune and talking with Pete Hegseth.
At 8:35, all that and more coming up.
Justice in.
If it wasn't stressed with our guest in studio, I'm really glad that carbon tax proposal went south in Washington, that they were imposing. That sounds like a horrible idea. Hey, it's Justice and Drew, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM.
Yeah, I'm not a big, I mean, I taxes do incentivize and disincentivize behavior. And if you're approaching it from that perspective of, you know, if the goal is, and I'm not saying I agree with the goal, but if the goal is, yes, you know, we want people to consume less fossil fuels, then yeah, that is an effective way to try to achieve that goal. I wish more politicians, especially on the local level, on the state level, would understand and sort of accept the notion that taxes incentivize and disincentivize behavior and stop taxing income. You know, I mean, they use it to try to get people to stop smoking.
Right.
You know, they use it to the sin taxes and all those
things. Well, look at what they're doing with the soda. And then now they're going to go, there's like $10 in taxes on a case of soda. So people they're driving out of state to go get their soda. No, knock it off. All right, hey, let's go here. We got a couple of stories, and then we're going to talk with Pete Hegseth. We may have to wait on the concealed carry one until tomorrow again. That needs proper shredding. And I completely forgot we were talking with Pete.
We need some time with that one.
Speaking of Pete, this is Peter. We'll go here first out of Yahoo. Peter Rabbit. Movie came out over the weekend. Didn't do very well in the box office. Did okay. It was like $30 million. It was okay. Not a lot of kids' movies out there right now. Peter Rabbit, the filmmakers and the studio behind it are apologizing for insensitively depicting a character's allergy in the film that has prompted backlash online. Can we please get to the point where we start to ignore the backlash online?
That would be nice.
Just ignore it.
Yeah.
Just because people have
the worst thing that's happened to society over the last 20 years is the ability to create an online petition.
Yeah, just because.
As soon as that happens, people feel like they have to start paying attention to it.
Sony Pictures said that in a joint statement over the weekend, with the filmmakers, that food allergies the food allergies are a serious issue, and the film should not have made light of a character being allergic to blackberries, even in a cartoonish slapstick way.
Oh my God. Just apologize for everything. You know, in fact, movies should just come with a big apology right at the beginning.
The rabbits fling fruit at Mr. McGregor, who's allergic to blackberries, in a scene, and then he's forced to use an EpiPen. Ha! Get it? Because they threw blackberries at him. That doesn't sound...
Allergies... Oh, my God.
It doesn't sound insensitive. It just sounds like bad writing.
Yeah, it sounds like kind of a lazy joke more than anything else. I don't know. I'm not going to see it. Maybe it's really funny. I don't know.
The charity group Kids with Food Allergies posted a warning about the scene on its Facebook page Friday, prompting some on Twitter to start using the hashtag #BoycottPeterRabbit. The group said the allergy jokes are harmful to their community and that making light of the condition encourages the public not to take the risk of allergy reaction seriously. Oh, get over yourself already.
You know what I don't take seriously? The risk of rabbits flinging fruit at me that I might be allergic to. Because it's a cartoon.
Reminds me of Avengers when Thor makes the joke about he's adopted, and then the adopted organization got all upset. The adoption organizations got all upset when he was talking about Loki. Yeah, just look. Just because people have the ability to put their opinion out there doesn't mean you have to take that opinion seriously.
Right.
And there were plenty of people...
And have a sense of humor about yourself.
There were plenty of people that had opinions about things already, but they didn't have the ability to go and put it out there. So it's not like anything has really changed, just the ability to put your opinion out there has changed, and we'd be better off if we'll just ignore those opinions more often.
I agree.
Just look at our Twitter feed. out of Complex, Marvel's upcoming film Black Panther. Now, when are you going to see it? When you got tickets for?
I don't have tickets yet.
Oh, you don't have?
I will see it this weekend.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Good luck. They're sold out a lot of places.
No, then I'll have trouble getting tickets.
Sam, do you have your tickets for Black Panther?
I will see it this weekend.
I have my tickets for Monday because we're taking Monday off. Okay,
Buffalo never sells out. I'll be fine.
They have a theater. Is driving?
No, it's actually a very very cute theater downtown that has real butter for their popcorn. Thank you very much.
So, Black Panther has a lot of things going for it. It's no secret that the movie has something different going on than most of the superhero movies. Nearly the entire cast is black. Not to mention that it tells a distinctly black story, according to the article here from Complex, making it a historic entry in the world of superhero movies and cinema in general, right? However, a change.org petition is asking, what exactly will the black community gain aside from another symbolic victory? The petition asks for Marvel to invest 25% of its worldwide profit in black communities and programs within these communities that focus on the STEM education programs.
No. No. You're not entitled to any of that.
Right.
I mean, it's just a bunch of people showing up with their hands out.
Chaz Gormley, he's the author of the petition, has not come without his receipts. He argues that as marginalized groups have become more vocal, corporations and their SAVIC public relations departments have turned to catering to these people to turn a profit, and Black Panther is no different. Gormley cites a clever, well-manufactured marketing campaign, Marvel Studios and their parent company, Walt Disney, that has specifically and successfully targeted the black community with its advertisements. It's being released in February, also known as Black History Month. He also notes that Gil Scott-Heron's The Revolution will not be televised, which sparks a larger issue of monetization of wokeness played in the background of the initial Black Panther trailer. He finds that using the two elements as marketing ploys is insulting.
You can't win.
Right.
Right, you can't win. So, you know, for you got this group saying, why aren't you doing a superhero movie with a cast member that looks like our community? Why isn't there a superhero movie where our children can look and see heroes that look like them? Okay, cool, we'll make one. Well, now that you've done that, all you're doing is just, you're just catering to us to try to make a profit. Well, which is it?
Right.
And you can't really have it both ways. You know, there's a demand for something, they fulfill that demand, and now they're bad guys for fulfilling that demand.
And look, if you don't want the studios to make these types of movies, then by all means continue to put out these petitions, because that's what's going to happen. The movie studios, when this was initially written, at the time of the writing, the petition had like 628 signatures out of 1,000. If I'm not mistaken, the last I saw, it was up to like 5,000 signatures. Now, it's not a lot, but it's more than what they were going for. Look, if the studios end up getting a bunch of controversy attached to movies like this, they're going to be hesitant to go and create them. And what really bothers me about this is what this guy who put this petition out there fails to realize. And that is, this movie already is set to make box office records. It's going to be hugely successful.
It's going to be, it's going to make bucket loads of money.
This movie will end up benefiting the very communities that he wants the proceeds to go to in ways well above and beyond what the money would end up doing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with the emotional impact for these communities, for these kids to see superheroes that look like them, right? This is groundbreaking on a lot of different levels. Not to mention, the movie is going to be successful, which means the movie studios are going to be more willing and are going to want to continue to serve parts of the community that perhaps haven't been served before with these types of movies, which could only benefit those communities. It is so short-sighted, in my opinion, that they don't look beyond that. Celebrate it. Promote it. Go out and buy more tickets. He'd be so much better. He'd be way better off going. And like some of the people that are involved in the movie, Octavia Spencer pledged to buy out a movie theater so people from underserved communities in Mississippi can watch it. Lupita Nyong'o's father scored a screening for people in her hometown of Kenya. A middle school went viral after announcing they would all go to see the movie as part of a day of cultural classes. It's already doing all the things that this idiot wants them to donate the money for.
And it's doing it because the people that are in the movie made a lot of money for being in the movie, and they're using that money to do these sorts of things. Later on, he writes, you have the ability to not only be entertained, but to leave the theater knowing that a portion of your money will be coming back into your community. Well, okay. That's already happening without this petition at all. And if that's the message, then why don't you just encourage people who are going to see the movie to donate some of their money to the community or some of their time or volunteer their efforts to help these communities? Why do you got to try to hold Marvel over a barrel, you know, just because you feel like they should do this? This is just a guy going to Marvel with his hand out. Because I guarantee you that he... In his world, some of this money would go directly back to him.
The movie also brought nearly $90 million to the Georgia economy alone where it was filmed. And the article on Complex does go on to say, it may not be 25% of the profits, but it's a small start anyway. And again, there's no accounting for the inspiration that the movie is going to provide. I mean, there's no dollar amount. You can't monetize that. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this does more damage to the movie and painting it in a bad light. Because you know, because the other byproduct of this that is, I hate to admit, is that there will be people out there that will be hesitant to go and see it. Because of people like this to do this petition. Oh, I don't want to go see it now. This guy's being dumb about it. And it's, yeah, you know, it's becoming all social justice.
There's a backlash every time some social justice agendas get attached to certain movies. We saw it with The Last Jedi. We saw it with the last couple Star Wars. There's a small segment of people that just sort of instinctively, once social justice warriors start attaching themselves to a movie, talking about, oh, this movie's so important. And just entertain me. That's all I want. Yeah, there's going to be it'll be small, but there's a portion of people out there that will be turned off by stuff like this. Yeah,
I do. These things are cyclical, and I have seen a bit of evidence of a proper amount of pushback when some of these little controversies pop up in the fan communities. I'd like to believe that hopefully we've maybe passed over the peak stupid part of it and we're circling back around. It remains to be seen. Thankfully, this petition attached to this movie is getting properly criticized, it seems like, across the board from everybody. Good. Saying,
and
look,
hopefully Marvel ignores it.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine they will. Dude, they're going to make so much money this weekend. it's slated to make. I mean, the lead actor, the guy playing Black Panther, made it on the cover of Time magazine for good. The movie alone. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it looks really good. I can't wait to see it.
Pete Hegseth from Fox News is going to be joining us. What are we talking about with Pete this morning? We got a list.
I want to get his thoughts on the infrastructure, the budget that Trump came out with yesterday, the infrastructure and the overall budget. We'll talk that. We'll talk a little bit about the Dem memo.
Oh yeah,
and Trump's decision to not release that one yet, and whatever's on Pete's mind.
651-989-5855. Use that hashtag TCNT on Twitter. We're back in just a minute.
You're listening to
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Justice Andrew, along with Sam. We'll be talking with Pete Hegseth in just a moment. The leader of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting slammed President Trump's budget request for fiscal 2019, which calls for the eventual elimination of federal funding for the agency that supports public radio and TV, including PBS and NPR. That makes me happy.
They get enough money, right?
Exactly. And they do those pledge drives.
Yeah, just add another pledge drive or two to the year. It's fine. That's the only time you show good programming anyway.
We gotta make our money.
You know? It's like they show great stuff during those pledge drives, and the rest of the year their programming sucks.
The CEO said Americans place great value on having universal access to public media's educational and informational programming and services provided commercial free and free of charge. Yes, I know. Yes, we all know.
The ratings would indicate otherwise. Americans place great value on Bachelor in Paradise.
We place a great value on our next guest, Pete Hegseth from Fox News. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. We also place great value in Sunday Night Football.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think we've got plenty of access to media, don't you guys? I don't know.
Yeah, more than enough. More than enough. I'm tired of these public broadcasting companies. I'm tired of public radio and public television. You know, getting the best of all three worlds, right? Because they get taxpayer money, you know, routed to them. Then they hold these pledge drives where they beg people for donations and pledges, and yet they still compete in the advertising market. They just package their advertisements a little bit differently. Like before the program, like this program presented by blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that's an ad. That's an ad.
This program presented by the Nature Conservatory.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, exactly. This is, but here's the thing. The worst thing about it for me is they get to sanctimoniously look at us in the eye and say, because we're publicly funded, we're independent, we're above the fray, we have no ideology, why they just ram left wing talking points down our throat.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Yep. Yeah. Out of the Hill, President Trump rolled out a White House budget, includes deep cuts to some federal agencies, an increase for funding for the Pentagon, $18 billion for the wall on the Mexico border. It includes proposals to cut deficits by more than $3 trillion over a decade and lower debt levels as a percentage of the gross domestic product, but does not balance by doing away with annual deficits. So give us your overall assessment, whether it's the $3 trillion in cuts on this budget. We would like your thoughts, too, on the infrastructure plan. But let's start here with the budget plan. What do you think?
Well, it's too big for anyone to have a full grasp on it right now. But
right.
Partly the point is that this idea that the Republican Party is the fiscally conservative party is basically out the window. Now, it's a trade we've made because of the policies of President Trump that we greatly support. But ultimately, because the economy is improving and jobless rates are so low and wages are going up, we're going to see interest rates can start to rise. And that means our debt's going to get that much more expensive, and it's going to crowd out other programs like defense. This budget doesn't really touch entitlement reform. Whatever savings it finds, for the most part, is through the sort of typical Washington gimmicks that get it balanced, 15 years down the road, except we're going to have three presidents between now and then that can do whatever they want with the budget. So those projections are never true, and they're never right. What matters is what kind of spending we put in place now that lives on forever as a baseline. And the reality is this is a massive increase in spending overall. But hey, if we get the wall and if we fund our military to fix what's done with sequestration, and then the priorities of this bill are reflective of this president, which is what people voted for. So not all good, but I guess good enough if you really do get. I think this immigration battle means way more than this budget, because the president's budget is always dead on arrival in the Senate and the House, and then it's sort of a starting point. But meh, $1.5 trillion.
Well, before
what's another $1.5 trillion, right?
Yeah, just throw it on there.
Before we shift over to immigration, because we do want to talk about that, the one thing about the infrastructure plan and the budget, and we mentioned it earlier, is it's these types of issues, it's these types of plans where you really do have to put your faith and trust in the individuals that you elected in Washington, D.C. to work through the minutia, because that's where it's going to be. You're going to need accountability. You're going to need to make sure that money is spent where it needs to be spent or isn't spent. If it doesn't have to be, we can handle the state level. And so for these types of plans, you've got to make sure that you've elected the right people to go and be your voice to make the right fiscal decisions
you. You've now officially depressed me. Because do we have those people? No, I mean, I think I found one of them, Rand Paul, who says none of us have read this bill. Leadership pushes it to the floor. We don't get to read it, and then we vote on it based on promises that they've made. How many times have we seen Mitch McConnell jam sweeteners in for his buddies in Kentucky? Time and time again. That era is wrought upon us, unfortunately, because our members of Congress aren't. They're more self-interested than they are in getting big things done. So I do like the fact that on the infrastructure bill, two things in particular, that it does push a lot of decision-making down to the states. It doesn't fully fund projects where there isn't investment at the local level. I think that is important. Block grants are good. I also love the deregulation on process for approval of projects. I mean, how absurd is it how long these projects take, how tied up in red tape they get, how much more expensive they become? If this president can truly streamline the approval process through all these federal agencies that are absurdly out of control, that's a big win that has very little to do with spending and more to do with cost savings. So I'm paying a lot of attention to see whether that comes to fruition.
We've made this comment several times this morning, and we'll say it again, and that is that, if any president is going to be able to get something done on immigration, and in particular DACA, it's President Donald Trump. And that's solely because for decades now, it doesn't really matter who's in office. Both Democrats and Republicans have used this immigration reform debate for their own political gain. And it seems like nobody's wanted to go and actually get anything done. And I'd like to believe, at least it seems as if, President Donald Trump does want to get something done on this. He's not beholden to either side. Do you feel the same way? Do you think there's a possibility that maybe under this president we could actually get something done?
I do. The question is what gets done, of course. But this president ran on immigration. This is his signature issue. It's where he broke with the base. And the reason why previous attempts by sort of rhinos like Lindsey Graham and others, John McCain, to make it, their position on immigration was far out of step with the Republican and conservative base. Now our leader in President Trump is in touch with, completely with, where the conservative base is, where American citizens are as it pertains to amnesty and a wall and merit-based immigration and things. We didn't even know about the diversity lottery program, most of us, until the president started litigating it and talking about how absurd it is in policy these days. So I think I agree with you. If anyone can do it, it's him. We'll see whether – what I'm frustrated with is to keep watching the same old gang of aiders drudge up their same old bill and say, no, no, we've added a little bit of this and a little bit of that. What we need to do is what the president has said is start with his benchmarks and then dare Democrats to be against this too generous of an offer that he made in $1.8 million with a pathway to citizenship. I would very much like to see that get trimmed back to the core group of DACA and to a path to legalization. But again, that's moving further to the right away from a Chuck Schumer and a Nancy Pelosi who say even the parameters of what the president proposed is a non-starter. So that both sides are dug in on their base views on this. The thing is, the Republicans control the White House in both chambers. It's going to be on them to make sure the bill stays right of center. I think a deal could get done. Will it happen by March 5th? I really don't think so. I think it's more likely they make some sort of a short-term deal, legalize DACA recipients for 3 years and then, you know, fund a portion of the wall and then come back to it. And I hope that's not what happens. But I also don't, you know, Geraldo Rivera has floated up a concept on our air a couple times, which I totally disagree with. He says, let's do the wall in exchange for DACA now, only those two things, and then revisit chain migration,
yeah,
the lottery system, and e-verify in a second bill. If you do that, you're never going to get to the second bill. It means you get the wall, but you keep chain migration, which means that 1.8 in DACA recipients are going to become 18 million in 2 decades as the chain migration continues. So I don't know. I'd like to see it. I want to make sure the wall is coupled with curtailing of chain migration, not just the wall itself.
Do you have, it doesn't sound like it, but I mean, do you have any confidence that it'll happen before this election? Or, you know, listening to you talk and sort of recounting the conversations we've had on this, I mean, when, you know, clearly there need to be bigger majorities, especially in the Senate, to actually get this done. Do you think can't get this done, is this something that you would, if somebody came out seeking Pete Hegseth's advice, run on this in November, you know, run on this when you're looking to unseat those incumbents that are preventing us from getting a permanent fix?
I think it's more important to get done, but if you can't, then I think this president reverts to what has happened every time he's tried to get closer to a deal, which is stepping back, realizing Democrats are not working in good faith, sending out a series of tweets that say, if you want a real immigration bill, elect more Republicans in 2018. I need reinforcement. So, yeah, I think if I was a betting man, I'd say this issue is still on the table in the 2018 elections. Republicans say, send more of us so we can really get this done. Democrats say, Republicans don't have a heart, even though President Trump made the biggest offer anyone's ever made for amnesty for this group. So I think it's more likely it goes to the 2018 election. I mean, they're picking the biggest and most contentious issue on the plate to solve in an election year against a president they hate with the fire of a thousand suns and want to impeach. So don't think that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are going to give him a win at all. The only thing they'll accept is something that makes him look really bad with his base, which this White House understands that if President Trump gives on the wall or gives on amnesty or gives on a big issue and doesn't get much in return, that's probably the one thing that could really hurt him with his base, when right now his base is squarely behind him. So both sides have electoral reasons not to come to the table, which is why you should count me as a little cynical. Although I like what McConnell's done in the Senate is actually interesting. You know, actual debate, actual proposal.
Yeah.
Who votes for it? 60 votes. I kind of like that. Let's see what comes of it.
No, and I like that too. But I do. But I do agree. I can't. Like, I was watching Schumer this morning, and I think it was a clip from yesterday when he was talking about, well, I don't want a big, he doesn't want a big immigration, the reform bill. He just wants something that is narrow when it comes to DACA. But then the narrow when it comes to DACA, they're going to start including all the family members, and that just gets larger and larger and larger. It's the same. It's the same thing they did when they were in power. And they had the opportunity to do something about the individuals who became the dreamers. And they did the same thing then because they didn't really want to solve the problem.
Well, of course. And then back then they were all for comprehensive immigration reform. And now they just want one thing, DACA.
Right.
It's a circle. And when you're in power, your job is to win. And the Republicans are in power, so it's their job to win. And if they can't, then they should find a way to get more reinforcements in 2018.
And we don't need comprehensive immigration reform. What we need is to enforce the laws we have in the books and then see what we got. We don't even do that right now.
Correct. I agree.
All right. Hey, let's move over to the memo, the Democratic memo in response to the GOP FISA memo. Where is that at right now? I know that it was loaded with a bunch of stuff that, you know, had to be classified so the president wouldn't sign off to have it released. Are they changing it? Have we moved off of the memo now?
From what I understand, and there could this news cycle, it could have changed 10 minutes ago, that a combination of the Justice and departments and the FBI and the Intelligence Committee are given an opportunity to sufficiently redact or make the changes they think need to be there. Then it can go back to the White House for approval, or of course the Congress could take it up and vote for it altogether, which they won't likely do. So I still think the Democratic memo comes out, but hearing from more people that have read it, I mean, they said there are literally lines in there where, like, this person talked to this person, talked to this person, talked to this person, talked to this person, and if you put that out, then the person who talked to the last person is probably going to die. So, or going to have some serious problems as an intel source in the future. The sources and methods thing is actually really real. So I think we'll get a chance to see something. I don't think you can withhold the whole thing. The question is how long.
Pete Hegseth from Fox News joins us every Tuesday at this time. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Look forward to catching up with you next week.
You got it. Bye.
Take care.
You know, something occurred to me in the middle of that conversation, and it reminds me of the frustration that we had with the GOP when Obama was in office, and they kept voting over and over again that 60 times to repeal, replace Obamacare.
Yeah.
And then when they got in power, they couldn't go get anything done. And that was this really stupid thing for them to do in the first place.
Right.
But the Democrats are the same way when it comes to this immigration deal. And it's becoming
more and more clear.
Yeah. They've dug their heels in so hard on this one. There's like no way that they can go and backtrack. When the reality is, I don't think that even on the left, I don't think they're gauging the frustration from the left in an appropriate way either. Because I still tend to believe that people want to see laws enforced. And if they could just get away from the labels that they've attached and just look at it on a very sort of rational level, if it's possible, I'd like to believe that even Democrats would like to see people held accountable for the laws, do something about the DACA recipients because you can't begrudge them for signing up for the program, and even they wouldn't have a hard time at doing some border security. But I think they're so fearful because of the narrative they've created that they refuse to ever go and give Trump anything.
And I still maintain that, and we've talked to people on the show about it before, but I still maintain that if you went to the majority of DACA recipients and asked them, you know, would you be willing to exchange border security and border wall funding for, you know, a permanent fix to your status and a path to citizenship, that they would, by and large, say, yeah, we're fine with that.
Yeah.
So who are the Democrats representing here?
Themselves. Yeah. Looking in the mirror.
Right.
Yeah. On tomorrow's show, we will get to that Reciprocity Act editorial from the Star Tribune today. And is Uber paying women less for driving better?
It would appear so.
How's that possible?
Have a great day, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
I hate having my face hammered.
Nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door. I'm Chris Addison. Here's a look.